Hey everybody, thanks so much for listening to the Riddle Metal Podcast. I truly appreciate it. This is episode number 17 already, and I'm having a great time. If you could, leave us a rate and review on Apple Podcasts, 5 stars if you're so inclined. I would really appreciate that. This just helps us get the podcast a little bit more out there. I'm trying to get it on more platforms like Google Play. Right now it's just on SoundCloud and Apple Podcasts, but so far, I'm receiving a lot of great feedback. People seem to really be enjoying what they're hearing, and that means a lot to me because this is becoming a little bit of a passion project of mine. So if you have any suggestions on how to make the podcast better or if guests you want to hear from, just let me know in the comment section of any of those platforms, Apple Podcasts or SoundCloud, and I'll let people know if I get it on Google Play or any other sort of platform that could help me get the word out. Thanks so much. Here is episode number 17 with Tim Nelson. What's up, buddy?
Josh, my man, how are you?
Doing well. It's always good to see you.
Absolutely. Well, it's good to be here. I finally made it. The Stubby and Tim Show. It's happening.
In eighth grade, Tim and I came up with the idea of having our own TV show. And in eighth grade, for some reason, everybody at Fairmont called me Stubby. So it's probably because I am short and stubby. So
I was about to say, for some reason, I think it's, man, you're about 4'10 and about 200 pounds at that stage in life. So you were pretty stubby, bro.
200 pounds?
Maybe that was me. I don't know. Either way, you definitely fit stubby.
I will tell you this. I really did keep an iPhone list or like an iPod Touch list in my notes of show ideas. For like episode ideas, you know what I'm saying?
I mean, so, were they like pretty well developed? Like, did we have some plot, you know, or was it just, hey, here's a bit, it's me, Stubby?
I think it was just a bit, you know, and I honestly could have wrote for Jimmy Fallon, if we're being honest here.
Jimmy Fallon's hilarious, man. Or I mean, well, he laughs a lot. I like the guy. I think he's a nice guy. You know what's funny, man? During this probably past 6 weeks, I've been really working on a show idea.
Like for what?
So let me explain it. And honestly, you could be a great sounding board for me. One, I trust your creative opinion, but two, I know you're a tough critic. You often make fun of my Instagram profile, so I want you to be just as honest about my show idea here.
Okay. All right. I can do that. Also, thank you for the kind comment
about
my creative opinion.
You're really mean. It's fine, though. Okay. So this would definitely make a lot of sense on like maybe a Hulu or like a Facebook TV kind of thing, to where you check in for like 20 minutes and then you check out. But basically, the plot of the show is falls around a main protagonist. He, like myself, young, very good-looking, 25-year-old living in Dallas. He sells...
Fits the description, yep.
Yeah, fits the description, right? Makes sense. So the plot of the story really kicks off is he sells his first company for like $100 million. So comes into a very large amount of wealth at an early age. And the main plot of the story goes, he gets the wealth, he buys a huge house, and then he lives there with 5 other roommates, and it's a story about them and their many escapades across Dallas, living in kind of this flamboyant, try-hard, fun life.
Okay, yeah, I mean, that could work. That's definitely a Hulu show, based on the Hulu shows that I've watched recently. So, like Dave, the one with Lil Dicky.
Oh, Phenomenal show, man.
Phenomenal show. Yes. Absolutely phenomenal show.
Now, have you seen Atlanta? Have you seen that show?
With Donald Glover?
Yes, sir.
I have not seen it, but I've always wanted to.
I think Dave is like, it's like Atlanta light. Like, if you're like, oh, I don't really want to talk about, like, race tensions as much. Or like, oh, I don't want to talk about, like, you know, this artistic creativity as much. Like, Dave is kind of a good, like, gateway drug into the real, like, deep, heavy stuff in Atlanta. That is a phenomenal show.
The first, like, I don't know, two or three episodes of Dave are focused around him, like, trying to be a white rapper and be taken seriously. And it has YG in it, which YG is a known Blood Gang member and is also a gangster rapper. So it's like, I don't know, man. It's such a good show. It's so funny. And you could tell, like, Little Dicky is exactly that way in real life. Like, that's his personality. He's just playing himself, basically.
I mean, he's a pretty good actor just from the show. I mean, I'm not out here being like, oh, yeah, great critical, you know, technique and stuff. But, I mean, he's not once, like, let me down in just what I expect from him on that show, which it maybe is kind of a natural role, but I think he's doing a great job with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Kevin Hart's involved with the show.
Oh, really?
Which, yeah, I think that adds a little bit to the show. But it's so funny, man. I want to welcome. I should have welcomed you, Tim. This is Tim Nelson, one of my dearest friends in the entire world. Always has been a great friend to me ever since the eighth grade when we met each other in first period math class.
Come on, bro.
When I just transferred to a new school. And we've been friends ever since. Tim is living in the Dallas area. So he's up in the Dirty D, as we call it.
Holding it down.
And he is a huge Astros fan, just as I am. We both grew up loving the Astros. We've been to many games together. He is prominent on the Instagram world. He is prominent in... He's in the running for Son of the Year every year. He's in the running for Brother of the Year every year.
Come on, bro.
I envy him with green jealous rage. And also, he's a bit of a musician himself. He's got a great voice. His father is a musician. Arguably, I would call his position a full-time musician, as he is a church minister of music and has been for a very, very long time. And his mom is very musical. His whole family's musical. So that makes him valid to come on the Rudimental podcast.
Shoot, man. That's an awesome welcome. Thank you, bro. Golly. Yeah, nice. Man.
That's what I'm known for in the podcast world.
Always give the family bio in the podcast world, man. Nobody does that.
Hey, I mean, not even Rogan does it, right?
Is that basis for everything on the podcast? Oh, hey, man, I haven't seen Rogan do this. I mean, I must be doing something pretty special.
The pod, the pretty much the pioneer of podcasting. I know he wasn't the first, but he definitely has helped me get into it. Yeah. I can't get Elon Musk or anything, but you'll do.
Second best. Yeah, they say I'm the Elon Musk of Dallas, so it's okay. It's like the same thing.
Right. Mark Cuban is, but it's okay. You are too.
I think that's maybe a theme for my life, Josh. The like, this is the best, but like, you know, you'll do. Like, this second best, like, this is okay. Like, let me tell you, I was having a really good time. The last time I went out before quarantine, I found myself at a venue, and there was a tribute band to the Ramones. Now, I've never
been.
I know. I've never been a huge Ramones guy, but they were playing, man. And for a bar that really didn't charge cover or anything, and it just had a live band, it wasn't the best, but it was pretty good, man. It was pretty good. Like, that's where my life is.
You have gone to more concerts, I think, than anyone I know.
I've counted, man.
How many?
Now, I got to put the asterisk here. With festivals, I don't feel right counting those individual concerts, so I'm just going to count that as one. Been to a couple festivals. But of all the live venues and concerts of every, you know, scale, even down to the cover bands, I've touched 164 concerts.
164 concerts?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Unreal, dude.
It's a
you,
fun
you
thing,
go to
man.
Some you go to some like you're a bit of a music connoisseur, as in like you listen to some bands that like I've never even heard of.
Oh, it's the same for you, dude. You I mean, golly, I feel like you're the only one that gets some of my tastes, especially jazz tastes. But yeah, I mean, I quite like them. I mean, you know, being a music guy yourself, Josh, do you feel like there's some concerts that just, you know, stand out in your memory? I know I have a few, but I want to get your take, man. Are there some that's just like burned in there and you're like, I remember this concert because blank?
Well, metal concerts will do that to you. Metal concerts have a physical aspect to it where you have to also watch out for your general health. Because a 6'4" jack dude just walked into the venue and he's about to annihilate you in the mosh pit. Not that I'm a mosh pit guy anyway, but I'm definitely going to consider, you know, at least participating. It's part of the metal culture. Then again, I haven't been to a metal concert in 4 or 5 years. Like that part of me is behind me. But the one concert that sticks out to me the most out of any of them is when I saw Snarky Puppy in Dallas at the Bomb Factory.
Yes, sir.
In Deep Ellum, in summer of 2018. That one really stuck out to me. It was just because they're considered a jazz fusion group, instrumental mostly. They kind of just do whatever they want. They're all like Dallas, like UNT cats, and I think now they're based out of Brooklyn or Miami, I can't remember. But Michael League, the bass player / band leader, is just he's a great musical mind. Their drummers are whoever's playing for them is always an influence for me. I think that night was JT Thomas, who's a Dallas cat. Other drummers that play for them is Larnell Lewis, Robert Sputt Seawright, Mark Lettigeri, I think that's his last name, on guitar. Just some really cool people. And I got to talk with them after the concert, and I knew all their songs. Like, it was just really good, great concert. I love the live music scene in Dallas, that's for sure.
Yeah, I know it's special, man. Just being here in North Texas, I mean, it was kind of the same shake that you had in either Austin or Houston. But people want to play in Texas. I mean, if you look at a band's concert schedule, at least the ones that I keep up with, you know, they're hitting Houston, Dallas, Austin. And then if they're picking one.
The thing about Houston, though, is like we only have like 4 venues, I think. Warehouse Live, White Oak Music Hall, House of Blues, and Scout Bar.
Yeah.
So I feel like Dallas, especially Austin, has way more options. I mean, like, they have bars and stuff like that that have, you know, bands and everything. But we have NRG Stadium where big artists play, and Toyota Center and stuff like that. But I don't know if Houston is up there with Dallas and Austin.
Sure. I think that's a fair point. Yeah, I would say in terms of venues, I think Austin's venue size accommodates me better. Because I like something like, if anybody's familiar on this podcast, Emos, that's a great size there. You yeah. can put 2,000 people in that room, but there's a sweet spot right around, you know, 1,200 or so, where you can get some good standing, you can still see, and it's just a great atmosphere. It's a nice wide stage. They've done something just phenomenal with the acoustics, to where even though it's just a big metal box, it still sounds great. That's my only downside with a few of the Dallas venues. I think some of them were like, hey, we can pull in some money if we just convert this, you know, space to a music venue. It's not a true music venue, and the acoustics are trash. So, I mean, that really makes it for me. Or I wouldn't say it's everything by all means, but I think being in the right venue, man, it can really set you up to have a better experience. I agree. Where do you lie on that, Josh? What's kind of your favorite venue setting for watching a show?
My favorite venue setting is ideally, ideally indoors. To be honest with you, this is going to be kind of a hot take, as I am a musician myself. I don't really like festivals. Sure. I feel like for instance, when I was a teenager, I went to Vans Warped Tour.
And oh, bro, come on, man. Was, that's classic.
It's classic, but it was miserable. I mean, like, I don't know, understand how, like, all you EDM folks, like, all you rave masters and all that kind of stuff, I don't know how you guys do it, because I have to be close. I like intimate settings. I want to be able to see the musicians, see what they're doing. I don't want to stand at the back of Cynthia Woods Mitchell Pavilion and try to see John Mayer on a screen. I want to see him. I want to see him up close. Like, and at the time when I saw John Mayer, I didn't have the money to see him or to pay for the seats underneath the actual pavilion. Cynthia Woods Mitchell Pavilion in Houston, I think, or in the Woodlands, I think that's a terrible venue. Hot take, I think it's an awful venue, because it's the lawn seating makes no sense to me. You're going to charge me $55 to sit on my own lawn chair and to watch four families around me with their kids, and they're all drinking beer. The kids too. No, I'm just kidding. But the to me, man, the ideal venue is an intimate setting that allows me to feel the energy of the performers rather than the energy of the other audience members around me. That's just my personal take on what an ideal venue is.
Yeah, I think that's valid, man. I like that, because I think festivals are special. I just like the variety you can get there. But I mean, you're right, man. Especially if you're seeing a festival in Texas or somewhere in the South, you're gonna get killed by the heat.
Man, I got Vegas too.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I don't care if they say it's dry heat; that Vegas heat will absolutely demolish you.
Yep.
Golly. I got two stories for you, Josh, about intimate concert settings.
Before you go into those, tell me,
please,
what concerts have stuck out to you, or what one concert has stuck out to you as a favorite?
That's good. I'm gonna pick two favorites, because I'm gonna completely just disregard what you said. I'm gonna choose my two, and then I'm gonna segue into my ideal setting story here. So, one concert that just always sticks out to me as something special that I can kind of take hold of and say, this is a unique time where I saw a band that I love, but no one will ever see them again. I was able to go see the Civil Wars. That's the duet between John Paul White and, oh gosh, I forgot the girl that's singing that.
Oh, they had a falling out, right?
They had a huge falling out, man. I didn't really, it wasn't any of my business, so I didn't dig around into the reason why. I knew it was a really big kind of power struggle and direction struggle, just from the basics of what I saw in their letter that they released. But yeah, I got to see them back in, I think it must have been like 2010 or 2011, and they disbanded right after that. And so, yeah, it's kind of one of those cool things I tuck away, saying I saw something that I loved, and the odds of ever seeing it again are pretty close to nil. So it's kind of a cool, like, hey, this was really neat. I saw something that was there and kind of gone.
Wow, that I used to love. They came out with one album, right?
They did one, and then the second one they released, they disbanded quickly. So I don't think they even had a tour from that second album that they released.
That first album, though, was great.
It's funny to me, too, because I feel like what they did, like, the concept wasn't special. It was taking one male vocalist and a female vocalist, both single artists, then pairing them together and saying, hey, sing folk, sing country. But yeah. I have not seen it repeated since then that I know of. At that level where it's like, man, they're just making these awesome harmonies with just very simple songs, and they're such talented vocalists, and John Paul White being a talented guitarist, they made it work, man. I mean, it was special stuff. Maybe us
the duo, but I don't know they're considered folk or what. I think they're married, too.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. And then Drew Holcomb does a project with his wife, right?
True. So, yeah, they definitely touch into that sphere.
Yeah, Drew Holcomb's great. Who was your second memorable concert?
So my second, it has a lot to do with the venue, but it's an artist that I've followed forever. His name's Matt Corby. Amazing musician out of Australia. Really doesn't do many U.S. tours, and he had one, and he was coming through Austin. And it was really funny, just the timing of it, because I was still a student at UT at this time. And he was performing on campus in an auditorium that was created back in the 1920s. So just a very unique setup where, you know, kind of a souls, blues, kind of guitarist and vocalist in this ornate older auditorium. So the kicker there is that, unlike most every other concert I go to, we were sitting down for this concert. And golly, man, it was awesome. I love being able to just sit down, because I feel like half a concert, and it's fun for like upbeat concerts, but half a concert I'm fighting for position to see the artist. I'm pissed off because, you know, the guy behind me is too close and somebody spilled their beer or whatever. And so I just hate the, and then my legs are tired from standing. But this was a special concert because it was in this ornate venue where we were sitting down, where I just became kind of lost in the music, man. And it was beautiful.
Well, that's similar to how orchestral concerts go.
Yeah, that's a great point, man.
Orchestral concerts and even wind ensemble concerts, choir concerts. And if you think about it, like operas are like that, where you kind of just sit down and the music is the focus, as opposed to, you know, this guy next to me has a beer, he's drunk, or this girl and this guy next to me are fighting and I can't focus. That's an interesting point. Nobody ever thinks about that. The sitting and standing thing makes a huge difference.
Yeah. It was phenomenal, man. It was such a unique time. And so I love that, because that really just took me there. It took me into the music, and I was able just to really enjoy it without having the stress of standing somewhere. But something that you pointed out with your taste, that I have a pretty funny story on, is just intimate concert settings and the idea of intimacy with someone, which I think maybe a topic we could explore, or maybe not. It would probably take about, you know, a couple hours to figure out. It's just that concept of stardom and the idea that there's like this this mental and sometimes physical block between us and people who are famous. But intimate concerts do a great job of breaking that barrier down, and I think that's why we like them, is we feel really connected to the artist at that time. And so I was actually out in Marfa, it's probably 3 years ago now, at a festival called Marfa Myths. It's put on by Mexican Summer, which is a recording studio out of Brooklyn. So just a breeding ground for hipsters. But Marfa, I know it was hilarious, but I was happy I was there.
There's so much coffee and craft beer,
beards and hats galore.
Thursday boots with real leather belts and real denim jeans.
All
right.
All jeans were cuffed, mind you. All cuffed.
Navajo print jackets.
Everybody just brag about James Turrell and what they saw of his. It was great stuff. It was really what you wanted to have.
Yes.
But for everybody who's listening that doesn't know what Marfa is, it's a town, probably about 2,000 people, probably maybe a little less, and it's about 7 hours away from Austin. It actually is only about 2 hours from El Paso, so it's way out in West Texas. But it's kind of become this kind of hippie desert commune. Josh, have you been there?
I have not. Where'd you say it was located again?
So it's just 2 hours east of El Paso, so way out in West Texas. But it's a cool place, man. There's a lot of artists out there that live there full time, and so it made for just a really interesting venue to be at. And so I was there about 3 or 4 years ago, and at this festival we were having kind of the mega night where they have a lot of the artists come up and perform. And there were some relatively big names in terms of indie artists. So there's one artist called Perfume Genius who I think is just awesome songwriter, awesome musician. Man, the showmanship of this guy is just great. And I remember I was just getting really into the music. I was at a venue where there's probably 300 people there. Everybody was spaced out, just really enjoying themselves. And I was pretty close to the front. And man, he was singing a song, and then, you know, the song ended and he was going to the next one. And then I kind of looked at him and I said, not in any sort of like a yell or something like that, I was like, man, this is great. And the artist, he kind of took a pause and he looked right at me and he said, you know, thank you for saying that. And I was like, whoa, wait, what? Because I felt like they just broke, you know, that wall that was there. And it was like, man, like, you heard my, you know, my claim that this was great and you interacted with it. And so I just thought it was special, because there was a moment where kind of what you're talking about with the intimacy with an artist, where it was like, okay, we had an interaction. It's not like I'm over here like, oh, like I'm starstruck, but just on kind of the opposite side of that, of like, wow, how human was that for him to be like, you know, like, hey, thanks for saying that. Like, you know, he's just a guy up there performing, enjoying himself and making music. And,
yeah.
And I think he enjoyed that interaction as well, to say like, all right, this music is meaning something for someone, and they're liking this experience. So I thought it was a cool moment.
Oh yeah, absolutely, man. Like, I've had some hit or miss experiences with interacting with artists like that.
Really?
And oh yeah. Like, I met one of my drumming idols. I'm not going to say who it is. But I went to the show by myself. I went to an acoustic show. And I was actually going to ask you about this guy, Noah Gunderson. Have you ever heard his stuff?
Yeah, sure have. Uh-huh.
He was on this show, but then this other guy was on the show, and he had this like solo acoustic act and everything, but he also played drums for one of the most prominent rock bands, especially like heavier rock bands in the 2000s. And I went to go meet him after the show and just be like, look, man, like, you're one of my biggest inspirations and everything like that. And he was like, oh, cool, man, thanks. And then walked away. And I was like, wait. Wait, come back.
Don't go.
So, and then, you know, but I've also had good experiences with people. Like I had a really good experience with this band, Chon. It's a little prog metal band out of California. I went and saw them in New Orleans with some buddies from college, and they were just the coolest guys, man. Like, they were just, I told them how much I appreciated their musicality, because it's, and oftentimes, like, some people just pick up a guitar and one day they're like, let's start a band, and then that band makes a really good couple songs and then they get big, and then it's like, man, I mean, like, no disrespect to you guys, but like, do you really know what you're doing? And these guys knew what they were doing, and it was really awesome to talk to them about their process a little bit, and along with some of the other bands. So I think that adds to the experience as well. Like, the possibility, like, because they're just people, right? I mean, like, obviously it's different if I'm going to pay, you know, some people pay, like, $500 to go see these artists that, and you're going to go sit in an arena that is supposed to seat 18,000 people, or sometimes you go see big acts like the Rolling Stones or John Mayer, or you go see, you know, like, Justin Timberlake or the Jonas Brothers, that's a big one recently, or Justin Bieber, Post Malone. The intimacy of the artist is gone. I mean, most of the time, I'm not going to have the money to pay to go sit front row of an arena show. Those are like thousands and thousands of dollars. So, and I have no chance of meeting that artist. Like, the intimacy added when you get to talk to the artist and tell them how much you appreciate their art. Now, that is something that I think is another level of appreciation for the intimate venue.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely agree with that. I think that's special. Man, something interesting, Josh. So ticket pricing, of course, is just atrocious, and I hate it, and I don't want to spend money like, you know, the next guy.
It may change after the quarantine or after the COVID-19 stuff, to be honest with you. But yeah.
Now, I was about to get into another topic, but I want to hear that thought there. I think we should spend some time on that. How do you think the ticketing, how do you think that'll change?
Well, I think live performance will change forever. I don't think I'm necessarily saying anything bold here. I think our world is going to be considerably different. Regarding, you know, cleaning procedures, or regarding the thermal, like, I'm hearing things about, like, thermal analyzers or thermal readers as you walk into a stadium or an arena or something like that. I think, you know, you're going to see standing room only areas have a little bit more space in between people just in general, because they're starting to think more about hygiene and general public health more. But ticket prices are going to have to go down to get people to go back out to these venues to see these people. I mean, if you look at Las Vegas is 90% entertainment and, you know, like 10% culinary. To get these people back in these casinos and these shows, I really think you're going to have to lower prices down to get people to be less afraid of going. Like, they're not going to be like, okay, I'm going to pay $120 a person to go see a show. Oh, and also I'm scared of this virus, or I'm scared of public health in general now. So I just think we're going to see a grand scheme of across all events like that, across all entertainment. You know, to go to a freaking Astros game, sometimes you're paying, it depends on who's in town, but sometimes you're paying $85 a ticket.
Yeah.
And sometimes you're paying $150 to $250 to go see your favorite artist at the Toyota Center or the T-Mobile Arena in Vegas. So I think to get people back out to live entertainment, you're going to have to lower ticket prices down for a good while.
Yeah. I think that's a good point. And I think, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and really say, like, oh, tickets will do this or that, you know. I mean, I'm with you. I'm skeptical to see what'll happen. You know, sadly, it depends on what course they're going to take, but I can see ticket prices also staying the same. For example, if we follow kind of a model that we see with Taiwan baseball, how they're letting fans come in, but the fans are sitting, you know, 6 feet, 2 meters apart from each other.
Yeah.
Then the ticket price will almost stay the same, because your supply has gone down by, you know, 80%, because you're just clearing seats in order to fit one person per 6 seats. So it would be interesting. I mean, I saw today there were plans for Major League Baseball to talk about a shortened season that would start in July. Now, I know, of course, what will determine if fans are actually allowed to go will be more federal and state policies. But I guess personally for you, Josh, if the Astros said, hey, we're starting games back on July 4th, and you were offered a ticket, would you go?
I would. Would I wear a mask? It depends if the roof is open or not. That's for sure. And it also depends on, you know, where the seats are and everything. I personally, I'm a little bit on the Elon Musk side of things, where he's saying, you know, the data is considerably lower than we thought. Mortality rates are lower. It really is only seriously affecting those that are older. And I'm not being unsympathetic to those that have been lost due to the virus, but
sure, yeah,
I think I'm getting less scared of what this thing is. I think I would go. I mean, I ate at a restaurant today. Of course, I'm in Texas, where we're pretty much being the control group for everything. But I ate a restaurant today. There was no one there besides the employees and maybe two other people. But I have a firm understanding now that we may have been overreacting a bit, but I'd rather overreact than underreact. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And I understand that. I could see at least a lot of the people that I talk to be in a similar boat where, you know, and I would say I'm in a similar boat. If I think baseball games are starting back up and they're starting to let fans in, I would consider it. Would I want to go back to a stadium at, you know, more than half capacity? Not really. I mean, you know, just trying to be, you know, on the safer side. But if it was something to where we were running at, you know, kind of 20% capacity, and there were certain controls and protocols to influence that safety, shoot, yeah, I'd love to go see a live baseball game. I appreciate that. I mean, I've always loved seeing baseball, but I appreciate that so much more right now because we can't do it. I'd say I'm more worried about college football just because I have so much money riding on the Texas Longhorns to win the national championship. So I got a lot I got to figure out there.
What were the odds? What was the line on that?
You know, I'm going to make a lot of money if they win. Let's just say that.
Okay, what was the line though?
I'm going to make a lot of money if they win. I don't want to say the line because it makes people not believe in the Longhorns, but I mean, if we get to play...
Was it plus 8,000?
Hey, man, I don't want to talk specifics.
Come on now.
Josh, you actually bring up a good point here. I think something I've kept my eye on, and this goes back to kind of one of my other interests with investing, but just the legalization and kind of the public IPOs we could see on the horizon for gaming, just for a couple different states that are legalizing it. You being our resident gaming expert and our gambling expert living in Louisiana and Nevada, I'd like to get your take, man. What do you think the future holds for the gaming industry, for the betting industry, especially in light of this kind of shutdown we have? Because I think there was a lot of steam. There was a lot of hype around it. I think DraftKings was had a pretty intense valuation, even for, you know, skeptic like me, had a pretty intense valuation. And I mean, I don't have a ton of background in it, but I mean, I don't know. What have you seen? What have you heard? Kind of the beat around Vegas in terms of gambling and kind of legalization in other states.
Well, I think people are starting, especially since you're getting professional sports teams in Vegas now, I think people are starting to realize that it's not as much of an issue anymore with professional athletes, especially. I mean, obviously you have your Pete Roses and you have your, you know, people like that, but and I think just because of the online factor, the fact that a lot of people do their betting on websites like betonline.ag, or they do it on DraftKings, they do it on FanDuel. The accessibility and the taxes that and the cut, you know, that the state could get from those winnings. And I think it depends. I know Nevada doesn't take anything out of winnings, but But I think people are starting to realize that the accessibility alone, it doesn't really make sense for a state to not have it legalized. I for one, I didn't partake in gambling at all when I was in Louisiana. But the accessibility of the casinos in Vegas and the online factor makes you just like, okay, I mean, I live in Las Vegas. Why would I not throw money down on the Seattle Seahawks 49ers game with my professor? Who, I mean, like, you know, you, I mean, who wouldn't do that? But at the same time, I'm also a sports fan, and so I have a little bit of an inclination when it comes to who I think is going to win and what I think is a really good line to bet on. I think the line that I bet on for the Seahawks game was the one where they went to overtime and the 49ers would have won, but their field goal kicker missed the game-winning field goal in overtime, so then Russ Wilson got the ball back and took him downfield and won in overtime. Seahawks, at that point, I think we're like on a ridiculous, I think it was either a win streak or they were like, they were doing really well in the season regardless. I think they only had lost like two games that so far at that during the point of that season. And they were sitting at plus 235 at Westgate's line. And I was like, why would I not throw $20 down on this? And they end up winning that game. And I was like, I like making bets like that. Like, I didn't put any bets on the national championship because
all right, man.
it was too much of a toss-up.
Of course.
Way too much of a toss-up. I think Clemson or LSU could have had it. I didn't see any LSU was the favorite, and I didn't see any reason LSU couldn't lose that game either. So, but get back to the original question. I think you're going to see, I think Texas is going to be one of the last states to legalize it. Just if you're pointing out states, I mean, Indiana, has just recently come on. I think, what was that other one that FanDuel, like, cause when I listen to these podcasts and stuff like that, a lot of them have deals with these betting, firms.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One of them is FanDuel, and now you can – every time you listen to the ad read, they're like, okay, they've added more states or something like that. And I think Indiana is the recent one. I just think it's the accessibility, man. I think they – I mean, what even is the original reason why sports gambling was illegal and is illegal in certain states anyway, you know?
I think it might go back to moral hazards. I think people see it as, I think that might be kind of rolled around in the generation where prohibition came from, where just another moral hazard, you know, you shouldn't be drinking, you shouldn't be gambling, you shouldn't be smoking, something like that.
Then it's along the lines with cannabis then. So
yeah, sure.
Nevada, look, Vegas is Sin City, right? Let's talk about Las Vegas for a second. Vegas is an adult playground, as my teacher puts it. It is 100% just like, honey, we're hiring a babysitter for a week, or we're leaving the kids with our parents for a week, and we're going to Vegas, and whatever happens there, we're not going to tell anybody. And that really happens. Like, people live different lives in Las Vegas, and that is fine. Okay? Do whatever you want. However, it's not as bad as people think it is. Like, when people ask me, what is it like living in Vegas? Are you tired of the strip yet? I said, look, do you think I go to the strip every day? No, I don't go to the strip every day. I go to the strip maybe once every 6 weeks. Mostly because it's a hassle to park in. Like, I would rather Uber to the strip then park in one of those parking garages. It's a nightmare. Anyway, Vegas is a regular city besides the mile and a half stretch of that one gambling boulevard of Las Vegas Boulevard. If you want to think about it this way, Vegas is actually trying to turn into a resort town. They're trying to make it family friendly. It'll never work, but they're trying. So, like, there's some nice stuff popping up, but Vegas is really just an entertainment place that, honestly, yes, it's an adult playground and everything, but there's great food, there's great shows, there's great live music, there's really cool stuff to see. There's Red Rock National Park. It's a regular city outside of that one boulevard. So if you use Vegas as the model with the general consensus mindset of, like, it's this horrible place, then, yeah, I don't think sports gambling is going to go, or gambling in general is going to go anywhere as far as a nationwide thing goes. But if, when people go there and they're like, okay, there's Vegas, the city, there's Henderson, there's Red Rock, there's Summerlin, it's actually a really nice city. It's a really nice place, and gambling brings in a lot of revenue for the state.
Josh, I think this is a perfect time to break and thank our sponsor for the podcast, the state of Nevada. Thank you guys for your generous contribution.
Thank you. All right.
Thank you guys for your generous contribution.
Governor Sisolak, thank you for your contribution. I don't know. I hope gambling. I'm not a big gambler. I will take the occasional sports bet. We took some sports bets while we were there. Tim actually predicted the Formula One winner of that race. Unbelievable. He took the Ravens to beat the Patriots, which they did that same Sunday night.
I made a little coin.
You made a little coin. Overall, I think gambling, I think you'll see more and more states start to open up with it, along with cannabis. I'm not a cannabis user myself, but it's getting to the point now where people are like, okay, let's look at some data. I think we're a really data-oriented society now. And I think people are just going to be like, all right, whatever. Just let people do it.
Can I flip that coin you're on, man? Can we put heads to tails on this?
Oh, you're going to zig to my zag?
I'm going to zig to your zag. First, let's thank our sponsors of State Nevada. I had a great time in Vegas, Josh. To your point, I can see how it could be a city where it really lives up to the Sin City name, and you can get involved with all the crazy stuff. But honestly, Vegas was a really great time. I loved it. Even the Strip was just fun. It's fun to be there. It kind of reminded me of Manhattan, how it's there's a lot of just stimulus, here and there with lights, all the gambling and stuff. And I mean, it was just a fun, interesting place to be in. It really had a culture of its own. So I had a blast there, man, and I think that was probably one of the most fun trips I took in 2019. Great.
Next time you come out, we got to play some golf.
Yeah, we really owe it to ourselves to do that, man. I need to. I've been improving on the golf game, man. This quarantine's been helping me out.
Yeah, man. I'm gonna try to play here next week. I think it's been a while for me. Vegas has some great golf. I'm still in Houston right now. We're doing another remote pod. Last week's episode with James worked really well, and so I'm just trying to get this pod more consistent. I mentioned that in Roberts, but the thing about doing a podcast is you don't really know what the end game is. I think mostly the end game with this one is that I just want people to know the people that I know. And I think a lot of the people that I know have great stories and they have very interesting lives. Like Tim is what is your official title? Your job title?
So I'm a technology consultant.
Technology consultant for a company in Dallas. And but along the lines of that, he's, like I mentioned before, he's a vocalist. Are you a baritone or a tenor?
Baritone, man. Yeah, good memory.
You are a baritone. You also have the knack. Like, your dad is a traditional gospel singer.
That's right.
Mostly, right?
Absolutely.
Powerful southern voice, a lot of vibrato. A lot of Gaither Vocal Band kind of like, kind of influence in that. What got you started? Like, did your parents just take you and your sister Angela? Did they take y'all at a young age and were just like, were they singing a lot in front of you? That's how you developed your ear and your technique? Or was that more of like your mom gave you lessons? What was it?
It's a good question, Josh. I feel like that is really the common thought and kind of always the question we get as a family is like, oh, I bet you guys, you know, grew up singing together. But the first, for about the first 15 years of my life, I was kind of fighting that. Because I saw that my parents loved it and they had it, but I really didn't want to be seen as the singer. It wasn't my thing. I wanted to just be, you know, the funny guy, the guy, you know, the smart guy. That's where I really found my own niche. And so it really took a lot of self-realization with singing to make me want to actually pursue it. So I'd say it took until probably midway through high school when I said, oh, gosh, like, I have the chops, you know. A lot of that is natural, like the voice, even though I did a lot of training with my voice and I built it up in order to sing classically and had a lot of voice lessons that were classically trained, the voice that I have, there's a lot of it that's natural. The ear that I have, there's a lot of it that's natural. So that natural talent, I think once I realized that and I saw the potential there, and of course, positive encouragement from my parents, even though it's nothing I really had been interested in before high school, that really pushed me. And then, you know, that junior and senior year of high school, you know, did competitive singing and made the all-state competitions. And that's when I realized, shoot, I'm pretty good at this. Like, this is something I should lean into. And it's a funny thing being a musician, man. And I'd say this is not a chapter of your life I hope you ever get in, Josh, just because I love music so much and I love your relationship with music. But I'm in that stage of my life where I'm a former musician now. Besides kind of singing just for, you know, in the shower, just here and there in the car, I don't do any corporate or solo singing. It's kind of gone for me. In college, I was in show choir and I was able to really just spread out and challenge my voice, taking on pop songs, doing jazz, doing more gospel, doing other just many different genres, country. I was able to really stretch it and challenge it and build upon that skill. And then after college, I did not make it a solo practice. I didn't take the responsibility on myself to pursue avenues to do that. And now it's a weird spot for me in music. I have days where I want to get back into it and really pursue it, but I think my resume says former musician, and so it's tough, man. It's kind of like every now and then I'm kind of mourning the loss of those skills, because when I sing, it's like, dude, that range that I once had, those, you know, that ability to really just hang a falsetto and nail a note is just so much harder now with that not being the common practice.
Right. It's almost like, you know, I learned a little bit about the voice in my undergrad, but those muscles really do need to be maintained.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, our chops need to be maintained as percussionists and drummers. But it's funny because if you went up to somebody who was a vocal major at UT or wherever, right? And you're like, okay. You're like, okay, I'm going to sing this song for you. Or like they catch a Longhorn Singers song or whatever. Were there vocal majors in Longhorn Singers?
There were. It's probably about half of us.
Okay. So I bet they had a little bit of jealousy when it came to your voice because of the natural ability of it. And they're like, well, I'm over here working and developing my voice. I have to work for it. And this guy just does it, right?
Sure, yeah.
The thing about that is that it is almost like you had an advantage, like you could have pursued it if you wanted to, but I think it's almost that the fact that you had so much of it around you as a kid that it maybe led you away from it as a career option. I think it's either or, right? Like if I grew up in a house full of percussionists, I don't know if I would be a percussionist.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So would you say So, like, your process for, like, how you go about learning music. So, you're mostly, like, you're not playing, you know, you're not singing original music. You're mostly singing, like, okay, I like this style of song, and I like this style of music, so I'm gonna sing this song by this artist, right? So, your process for learning a song at that time, was it a lot of, like, was it sheet music reading? Was it a lot of ear and memorization? When you sang harmony, was it taught? Did you need a reference note? Like, if the key was A, did you need an A played so you can hear the scale in your head? Like, what was your process?
So I think the process was really different in each life stage. Which I think makes sense. I think as we learn and as we grow proficient in a skill, there's building blocks that are built, right, that kind of be put down as that foundation for a house. And then later in our career, we're not paying attention to the building blocks. That foundation's solid. You know, we're building the roof now. And so I'd say in high school, a lot of it was sheet music and just heavy, heavy repetition. But then in college, and even still now, even though I don't have those vocal muscles built up, I mean, I can listen to a song or hear, you know, a part in church when somebody's singing, and I got the harmony. Like, the harmony sticks out, and so I can engage with it almost immediately. And that's you know,
are you picking intervals at that point, or are you just kind of? So you can hear a third, fourth, fifth above what you're hearing.
Yeah, yeah. I would say it depends on the song. Some songs are definitely easier to really pick that out. But I can. But, I mean, of course, Josh, that's building blocks of 10 years, which you get. I mean, you didn't roll into drum class, you know, drum practice today and say, all right, let's start, in the same process that you said, let's start, when you were in ninth grade, right?
Right, yeah. See, that's super interesting to me. Because while I did go to school for two music degrees, I still don't really believe that you need that to develop your musicality. Like, it's just the route I took because I needed that structure. I needed to grow up, and I think college was the only way that I was going to be able to grow up the way that I wanted to. But that musical ability in itself is something that, like, that is a huge skill to have, like, and to develop, even if it's just in an academic sense. Like, if I'm in a school group and I develop that skill, that's a huge skill to develop, because there's a lot of people who call themselves singers, and you're like, okay, but can you really hear what you're supposed to be doing? You find that a lot in church musicians, and there's nothing wrong with church musicians, but it's rare that you're like, okay, this person's just singing above the melody because they think that's what harmony is, or they're singing below it.
They just don't know where it's at.
And I'm behind the drums, and I'm just like, oh no. But what would you say was the height of your vocal skills?
That's a great question, man.
Longhorn Singers, maybe?
I would say, maybe for raw skills, for raw music skills, I feel like that maybe was kind of senior year of high school, when on a daily basis I was getting in and just practicing sheet music for all state tryouts, and I was doing sight reading, so that musicality skill was just off the charts. But man, for enjoyability, it was definitely in Longhorn Singers by that senior year, where I could listen to a song and I could just kind of hear the way that I'd want to break it down. For example, the new Basement Tapes, they recorded a song called Kansas City, and me and about four friends, we took that song, which is with just one male lead vocal. Is lead singer Mumford and Sons, but he does that song in the new Basement Tapes, and we said, you know what, this would be a great song in four-part harmony, and we were able just to sit around, talk about it, kind of you know, with a little bit of direction, just point those out, and then we're able to just go forth and make some music happen. And we really enjoyed that performance. So I would say that that kind of classic, you know, musicality skill, it kind of peaked in high school, which is my ability to pick up a sheet of music and read it. But for enjoyability purposes, right at the end of the college, when I felt like kind of that well-oiled machine, like I was kind of ready to go to pick up, you know, harmonies, or ready to go into kind of just be able to break down a song and take something that is great and recorded by a professional artist, and you know, they were creative to create it, and then have my own spin on it and say, okay, this is what we're doing. This is, you know, Tim's cover, or this is Tim and my friends. This is our cover of this song. I mean, that's just a ton of fun. Josh, I don't know how much experience, you know, I know you do a ton of gigs, but man, just taking a piece of music and saying, all right, this is Josh's, this is my own.
Well, I learned more about that in grad school than anything. Grad school was about really developing my musicality as opposed to like the technique foundation of everything, if that makes sense.
Sure.
Grad school for me, I had to learn how to take the notes written on the page and make them my own. Because in reality, when you buy a piece of music, or when you're learning a piece of music, the composer has done their job, right? The composer has said, these are the notes that make my piece. Now you take them and interpret them. So some would argue that you need to play what's exactly on the page and maybe do a few little things here and there, like phrasing wise, to make it your own. And there's other people are like, take everything that's on the page as suggestions. So to me, my teacher, my graduate professor, he took everything as suggestions. And I really like that because it takes the pressure off, right? And the pressure of trying to get something right as opposed to making music is extremely different. And it's way more fun that way. So if I have a piece of music that I want to learn, I'm going to interpret it my way and view the notes on the page and all the expressions written on the page as suggestions.
I like that, man. I feel like that's art. And not to make that sound like, you know, just a useless blanket statement. But I think really taking something, music, visual, whatever it is, and making it your own as art. Like, can you argue, is this good art or bad art? Yeah, we can argue that. I mean, not every painting or visual art people will like. So you can say, yeah, this is good art, this is bad art. But I think that's your artist coming out there, Josh, saying, I will take what somebody set before me, a platform, a template, and then adapt it through my own creativity. And it says, hey, this is Josh's style. This is what I'm doing with this piece, and this is demonstrating artistry.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that, because that's really the goal you're going for, right? I mean, especially in a solo setting, but you know, when you're in an ensemble setting and like yourself, like when you're in a swing choir or a show choir setting and you're working together with other musicians and you know their tendencies and you know what they're going to do as far as like their musical choices go and how they're going to take this musical situation and make it their own. That's important as well. And it's important to, once you establish like everybody is on the same page, the artistic expression that comes out it's game over. It's endless. And I feel like that when you look at things as suggestions, like the original version of a song that somebody wants to cover, if you look at that as a suggestion, as an artist's way of saying, okay, this is what my interpretation was at the time. If you look at somebody like Ed Sheeran, he plays his songs differently every time. If you play them the same way every time, you would go insane. It's not even a debate. You would go insane. So the musical choices made in whatever setting, I think, are meant to be suggestions every time. I don't think there's any set way. Some composers would argue with you, like, Some composers are divas, or some composers are very stringent about the instructions they give on their pieces of music, and that's fine. But you're 99.9% of the time, the composer will not be sitting in the crowd. So it's kind of like 99.9% of the time, the lead singer of Mumford & Sons or the lead singer of the Civil Wars, they're not going to be in the crowd. So that's where the art comes through, is the interpretation of what a suggested version of it already was.
I like that, man. I feel like I got a bold question to ask you, Josh.
Say that again.
I have a bold question for you, man.
Okay.
In your life, what do you feel like are the barriers that you're facing right now that stop you from being the creative artist you want to be?
Well, I think it's a couple things. And I don't feel like they're tangible. In a sense of, I think it changes a lot, and I don't think they're very set in stone. But right now, I would say, especially with all this COVID stuff going on, that the main barrier is fear of stability financially, and also the fear of not being fulfilled.
Sure.
In pursuing a career in performance. It takes a while to get going, especially in a city like Las Vegas. You know, I am qualified to pursue a job in education at the high school level, make really good money, have benefits, and actually, you know, have, like, in quotations, a real job. And that would take care of all my financial troubles, right? But the crossroads that I'm at now, and I would consider a barrier, is do I want to pursue this and just struggle for a while, you know? And financially, I do believe that playing speaks for itself, and that networking is huge, and I'm a decent networker, and I'm going to continue to build that net. But I think fear is a barrier. And another thing is the fear. I think it all stems from fear, but the fear of putting myself out there and not being accepted or not being respected. And that goes for the art itself, the playing, the music being made. If I go the route that I've dreamt of going down for a few years now, and that is going down the performance route along with some composing, some arranging, that involves a lot of putting myself out there, which I don't know, because I've always been very hard on myself, and I've always had a little bit of performance anxiety. So doing this is all or nothing, right? I mean, if I don't put every bit of myself out there on the stage or in the YouTube video or in the recording, then I don't have a career. So that barrier of the fear of not being respected or accepted is very, very real. In fact, I think it would be a little bit above the financial thing, because I can stretch some money out. Like, let's not deny my skills in stretching money out. That's for sure. But it mainly is the putting myself out there thing. To be a true artist and to be a true creative, you really need to put every ounce of what you are into your art. And that is very, very scary. Because we're all vulnerable, right? But to actually put yourself out there through a medium like music, every ounce of what you are, all your faults, all your positives, all your in-betweens. It's very, very intimidating. So that to me is at the top of the list of the barriers.
Josh, that's raw, man. That's good stuff. I mean, one, I got to tell you, that's great that you're able to identify that, because that could have been an easier question just to say, bah, I don't know, and then just kind of keep moving on and not address that. So, I mean, kudos to you for being able to work
through that. Well, I think about it a lot.
Yeah. Of course, that's your life, man.
I think about it a lot. Yeah, I mean, because it's the same thing with education, right? I mean, your mom could speak to this, your sister could speak to this, sure. Is that education involves 100% commitment. Like, you're molding other lives. And I think that it's, for one thing, like, I don't believe anybody's successful if they don't work hard and they're not committed. If you look at somebody like this Last Dance Michael Jordan documentary is going on, and the man was 1,000% committed to his craft, and the accolades show for it. So I think, and regardless of what route I go down, I'm going to be 1,000% committed. I'm going to try to be Michael Jordan with it, but that also comes with the fear barriers and everything that I think about a lot. And I think if I didn't think about them, mostly because I'm very analytical. I'm a very analytical person, but I definitely have analyzed them to a point of like, okay, I now know what the start of each path is going to look like. And I don't know what the rest of the path looks like, but I definitely know what the start's going to look like. And I know what I'm going to have to get over and try to, and try to conquer as I go down the path, you know?
I think that's an interesting point you bring up, Josh, about commitment. Especially, kind of in light of that MJ style of commitment, or I maybe think of a Steve Jobs style of commitment. Maybe another term that could be used in tandem could be just an intense focus on something in front of you. Whether that runs your daily operations or not, there's still this long term goal in sight that says, okay, my priority is based on this goal, and it's obvious through my actions that I'm committed and focused on this. Is that something that, both Steve Jobs and Michael Jordan, those are two very unique individuals. I would argue there's not a lot of people out there like them. So do you think that level of commitment, that level of focus is something that can be learned and achieved by kind of anyone that shows, some resemblance of intelligence and some resemblance of focus? Or do you think that's something that's really a bit more personality to have that kind of commitment?
I think it's a little bit of personality. I think it's only going to be taught to the people that have that personality. I think those kind of have to go hand in hand. If you look at somebody like Steve Jobs had a little bit of a reputation of being a little bit strict himself and being a little intense himself.
Oh yeah.
And MJ, man, I mean, the dude deliberately said like, no, I wasn't nice, but I won a lot. And the person who didn't have my mindset didn't win a lot. So the only way to view yourself as successful in basketball especially is by winning. And Steve Jobs was successful by the product that he introduced to the world, and the multiple products he did and envisioned and innovated. I think that is only taught to the people that have the same personality. I view a lot of, I guess, I think about music as a competition in a sense of like good competition. The music itself, there, nothing should be really compared. I think maybe if you wrote a piece that was going along the same idea of developing a technique and you're like, okay, well, this one's actually better for something like that. But competition as in like, what am I doing to ensure that I keep my gigs, that I get more gigs, and that I meet more people, and that I do more media, and try to make my contribution to the music community. One of them being, you know, this podcast, building my YouTube channel. I think that I am putting myself into a better place because I'm doing more, and I'm doing more at a commitment level like Michael Jordan and Steve Jobs. So that's kind of how I look at it. I feel like you have to have that personality that they have or Steve Jobs had. And I feel like people who want to learn and to be successful and to innovate and commit and to also contribute like both of those gentlemen have, I think they have to share the same mindset to learn. So I think personality goes hand in hand with the willingness to learn and the ability to teach that kind of person.
Yeah. I would definitely agree with that. I find mindset, to be a big one. And I think something that might be underlying this conversation, that's a good call out that I feel like I've been, just running into recently, is the aspect of trade-offs in light of this mindset, in light of commitment. For example, mm-hmm. I listen to a podcast called How I Built This. It's an NPR podcast hosted by Guy Raz, where basically he brings on these entrepreneurs, and they talk about their company. They talk about what it takes to start it. And with a lot of their stories, although they vary wildly in terms of background, they have very different personalities, there are these very strong themes of both mindset and trade-off. Mindset being, I know what this takes and I'm willing to put it in. Something very simple, like a simple product would be Stacy's pita chips, but she just had an awesome story to how she started the business. Basically, she was hustling in Boston. She had a small little, you know, falafel stand that she would go to, and then eventually she had it herself where she would own it, and then she would throw away her old pita bread at the end of the day. But she said, instead of throwing away this pita bread, let's just take this stale pita bread and bake it one more time and then sell it as chips. Well, from that point on, it wasn't like she hit success. But instead, she went through a 10-year process of baking these for her small shop in Boston, taking on a partnership to go full-blown and to produce these, going through financial trouble, taking on deal after deal to get enough financing to make this happen and get these pita chips out there, going store to store to try to sell these so she can get them inside of grocery stores, and then finally landing a big deal with a large snack company. So that mindset and that trade-off factor for 10 years. For 10 years, she said, I'm not going to put in extra work on this. It's fine. For 10 years, she said, I'm going to set aside my my living styles and any sort of lifestyle scope that I want to have. I'm going to just diminish that for the sake of this company. And that's what I've been struggling with, man, because I think you know, for a while I've been wanting to just take a stab at starting something myself and get something going. But the trade-offs are big, especially when holding a full-time job. It's like, okay, my trade-off isn't I'm going to make this my full-time job. My trade-off is I need my full-time job to have a salary, to have money to live. And then right. At night, I have to sacrifice those last 4 to 5 hours of my day and say, this is for my company. This is for building something. Same application for musicians, same application for artists, but it's those two components that I don't think a lot of people have appreciation for is mindset, and then this concept of trade-offs. There's big trade-offs that have to happen.
And you know, everything pays dividends. I mean, she didn't quit for 10 years.
Right.
And if it takes 10 years to make your impact, then it takes 10 years. If it takes 20 years, it takes 25 years, it takes 50 years. I mean, the mindset is not – it that has to be self – I believe that has to be self-manifested, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think everyone has a destiny. Some – are bigger than others, but I feel like if you put the time in and you put the work in and you really, and you just don't quit, I really think, and I've just seen this from my own experience, this very minute amount of success that I've had. I think good things happen if you do that. And I think if you're willing to struggle for a bit, and if you look at the bigger picture constantly, I think it all pays off in the end. I mean, like, and I've said this before on earlier pods from a couple of years ago. I feel like the business world and the artist world have a lot of similarities. I feel like athletes and artists have a lot of similarities as well. They're dedicated to their craft. I feel like networking and the business side of things have a lot to do with how networking and business works in your world and in your job. I think all this goes hand in hand, and I think everything pays dividends. I think honestly, if I go down this route that I feel an urge to go down, I think it's going to work out in the end if I just make sure that I'm dedicated to the craft. And I'm dedicated, in your sense, I'm dedicated to this business idea.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to see what the fruits of my labor are going to be at the end.
Yeah. And I think it's worth a shot, man. I mean, I know we're talking generalities and just, you know, these overarching concepts here.
Well, we have to, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I like to do this segment that I used to do a long time ago when I did the pod in Lake Charles, but I just like to ask people at the end, like, what they're listening to, what kind of stuff are you listening to right now, Tim? Who's the artist for your go-to right now?
That's a fun question, man. I like that a lot. And let's see, let me open up my Spotify and see what we got going on. Man, okay. I'd say theme for 2020, been doing a pretty good amount of kind of the Rap Caviar playlist on Spotify, and then throwing in some old classics. So, I mean, we're talking Travis Scott, we're talking T-Lop album from Kanye. We got a little bit of the new stuff from ASAP Ferg. And then, golly, dude, I don't know why this happened, but I just remembered Backseat Freestyle was a song. So I feel like that's a once a
day. Oh, the Good Kid, Mad City album.
Absolutely. So I feel like that's like a daily kind of rotation there. Man, let's see what else. I don't know if anybody else does this, but I always use my like songs. It's kind of like my most recent kind of go to rolling playlist. Yeah. I think what I've been into right now is this kind of laid back acoustic vibe, and then also a pretty good amount of jazz. So
who's some jazz artists you're listening to?
Bad, Not Good. Are you familiar with them?
Oh, good choice.
Yeah, man.
Great stuff.
Just an awesome group right there. I'd say one of my favorite jazz groups. And let me pop into them. I think it's either a Norwegian or a maybe it's something Scandinavian, just because the name of their songs have a lot of Scandinavian letters in them. But it's Brimmer McCoy. I don't know if you're familiar with Brimmer and McCoy.
I am not, but it's very possible that, like, they have a lot of they're either from the Netherlands or something like that, and have a lot of like Dutch influence.
Yeah, heavy piano. Really enjoying it, just for kind of a focused jazz. Just something I can play in the background when I'm working.
It's good to listen to some instrumental stuff while doing a task because I, for one, while I'm not the main, like, lyrics are not the main thing that I listen to, it does help to not have lyrics going on or, like, a vocal happening while you're doing a task like that.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's a really good point, man. And I'd say the other thing that's just been, like, a really nice thing just to put on kind of right after work when I'm chilling in the backyard or going for a walk or something like that is Unknown Mortal Orchestra. Are you familiar with them?
I am not.
Man, dude, just a sweet, sweet little blues number. I don't know if it's – it might be just, like, kind of a one-guy band, kind of like a Tame Impala thing where, you know, he'll fill in with some, like, random people to play other stuff. But Unknown Mortal Orchestra just has this sweet little like blues, but like fusion sound to it. So if you're looking for specific song recs, Necessary Evil, man, that has just been a great song just to bebop around to.
I'm really liking your sparked interest in jazz.
Oh yeah, man, I know you would.
I've been kind of along the lines of like lo-fi, kind of like chill beats, instrumental stuff. The producer Tom Misch just came out with a new album called What Kind of Music. It's with the drummer Yusuf Days. I believe he's a British, mostly jazz drummer that he plays some sick, just some ridiculous stuff. But all these songs on this album are based off just random jazz sessions they had, or jam sessions that they had in the studio. And they're brilliant, brilliant pieces of music. I think you would like them. Tim, I'll send you this album suggestion. But so I got Tom Misch, and I'm also into an older album from 2007 from one of my favorite rock bands, Circus Survive. It's On Letting Go. It's probably like their staple album. Got back into some Van Halen.
There you go, man. I like that.
The Bob Seger days. And let's see. Hip-hop-wise, I actually turned on Kanye's College Dropout the other day. That was cool.
Throwback.
Put on Watch the Throne a couple weeks ago. Love it. I know there's not a single skip on that album. I like to wind down with some James Taylor. So that's kind of where I'm at right now. I'm still a very avid podcast listener just because I've been surrounded with music most of the day from what used to be my studying and practicing and stuff like that. But, you know, I'm starting to get back in some staple albums that really develop my musical taste. So it's kind of where I'm sitting at myself.
I like that, man. You know, it's funny, is hearing kind of your throwback to some older hip-hop and especially College Dropout and just those older albums. Somebody that I've been spending a lot of time just exploring with music is Blood Orange. I don't know if you're familiar.
I'm not.
Man, just an awesome, like, 90s style hip-hop to where you'll have these modern beats but applied to this really cool, like, I mean, just unique synthesizer and just, you know, hitting these notes that, like, really make you think of kind of like a 90s early hip-hop. But it has a lo-fi, kind of chill, modern beat to it. So I definitely recommend checking out. Angel's Pulse is an album I've been listening to from Blood Orange. It is, it's awesome, man.
That reminds me of Channel Orange, the Frank Ocean album.
Dude, that's top 10 right there, man.
Absolutely.
That album does not mess around.
No, absolutely not. Well, Tim, I think that's a good place to wrap up.
Absolutely.
You've let the people know what you've been jamming. So, thanks for coming on, man. I really appreciate it.
I've been wanting to get on, Josh. It's a dream come true, man. This has been really fun.
Thanks for the time, as always. And, yeah, man, I hope that all this stuff wraps up soon and that we can travel to our obscure places list as soon as possible.
Boise, we're coming for you.
Side note, Tim and Robert and I, along with Drake, have a We have an obscure list of places to visit. We're going to Milwaukee next. Following that, we'll either be Raleigh, North Carolina, Kansas City, or Boise, Idaho. So we'll see. We'll see. Oh, we talked about Nebraska too. So,
bro, Lincoln.
The last place we went,
sleeper city. The last sleeper city.
Last place we went was Oklahoma City, and it sucked, dude. So
nothing could be worse. So yeah. It's a great place to start, and then only goes up from here.
Yeah, man. Well, thanks, Tim. I appreciate it.
Absolutely, Josh. Thank you, man. Have a good one.
All right, man.